Coming up on Simply Superior.
Simply Superior, news and issues from a superior point of view.
Seven islands to the high side of the bay, across the bay.
It's not seven islands, but 21. And they're celebrating 50 years.
We all do love these islands. They are a national treasure.
Plus, along with the science, we'll hear the art of the archipelago with Apostle Island's poetry.
Tell me your secrets, Gitche-Gumi. I want to know what alchemy spins the summer sky to gold and black, magic nights. Tell me of your love and gentle swells.
Those stories and the regional news and review after this.
Issues from a superior point of view.
Seven islands to the highest side of the bay, across the bay.
It's not seven islands, but 21, and they're celebrating 50 years.
We all do love these islands. They are a national treasure.
Plus, along with the science, we'll hear the art of the archipelago with Apostle Island's poetry.
Tell me your secrets, Gitche-Gumi. I want to know what alchemy spins the summer sky to gold and black, magic nights. Tell me of your love and gentle swells.
Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. We all know the Apostle Islands as a gift of nature, and some of them are our own little secret. They officially became a national treasure on September 26, 1970, with their designation as a national lakeshore. This anniversary year has seen numerous commemorations, including a symposium 2 weeks ago on every scientific aspect of the islands, as well as cultural and maybe just fun. Joining us to review some of those presentations is Jeff Renicky, Executive Director of the Friends of Apostle Islands. Welcome to Simply Superior, Jeff.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
And the Friends is not, you're not the people who run or certainly don't own the islands. There's a distinction between you and the National Park Service, correct?
Correct. The islands as a national lakeshore are a national park unit, which of course means they belong to all of us. But the National Park Service is charged with the mission of protecting and managing them. The Friends of the Apostle Islands is the official philanthropic partner of the National Park Service here in the Apostle Islands. It's our job to help fundraise for projects that the park might need a little help with and that people may want to join in with. So we were very happy to be a sponsor of the 50th anniversary Resource Stewardship Symposium with the Park Service.
Right. And it must be great to be a friend of something that everybody loved.
We all do love these islands. They are a national treasure. And this was, being a friend of the Apostle Islands is a way for you to display that love for the islands and a way for you to give back. A lot of times people will come to these islands and fall in love with them and ask, how can I help? We help you help.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, we can ask you to tell us exactly how people can help in a minute. But going to the symposium, what are some of the parts that stood out to you? And I know, I think you're not a scientist. You could be a secret brain surgeon, I understand. but certainly, you know, there's all the different aspects. It's a science wonderland, right? So what stood out to you?
The great thing for me about this conference is it was the 50th anniversary symposium. So one of the goals of the conference was to kind of give a historic overview. And I've lived in these islands for more than 30 years, but sometimes we forget just what a treasure trove of scientific research these islands really are. You know, sometimes people think of a national park unit like a postcard. It's a place to go for beauty or to walk a beach or to go sailing or recreation or adventure. And certainly it is all those things, but it's also such an incredible gold mine for biological research and to monitor changes over time, particularly in an island setting where the outside influences are more delineated. It's almost like These islands are laboratories out there waiting to be studied. And this particular symposium gave us a chance to put not only put the last 50 years in perspective, but to talk about where we are and where we might be going in the next 50 years.
Mm-hmm. Some of those laboratories are, well, there was a workshop on amphibians and then songbirds, and of course the piping plover. We can't go without that one. Did you learn something from any of those, or which ones do stand out to you?
Well, particularly the songbirds, the incredible diversity of the songbirds in the islands, and how the songbirds in the migration patterns use the islands like stepping stones to help cross the big blue dangerous Lake Superior. The songbirds, as we heard, will hop from island to island to on their north and south migrations, so they're almost like stepping stones. But then just the incredible diversity of species in the islands that you can hear on a spring morning when the songs start kicking up, and you may not even be able to see them, but you can hear their songs. These islands are so much more filled with life than we might think, and that was the big takeaway for me.
So let's hear from one of those presentations, A Singing Wilderness, Songbirds of the Apostle Islands by Ted Gostomski.
Good morning. My name is Ted Gostomski. I'm a biologist with the National Park Service, the Great Lakes Inventory and Monitoring Network, which is part of the Park Service's Inventory and Monitoring Division. And I am the coordinator for songbird monitoring in 9 Great Lakes Network parks, including Apostle Islands. And so I have the privilege today of talking about 50 years of songbirds in the Apostle Islands. The most abundant birds, the red-eyed vireo, the ovenbird, the black-throated green warbler, the vireo, and the blue jay. 4 of these, the vireo, the black-throated green warbler, the vireo, and the ovenbird, are what we call neotropical migrants. They're birds that breed here in the north in the summer, and then they migrate south to the southern U.S. or Central and South America for the winter. That's an important thing. These neotropical migrants are the ones that we're most concerned about because a lot of changes that we see in populations actually occur on those southern wintering grounds. In 1990, in addition to those 5 species I mentioned, the red-winged blackbird, the Nashville warbler, the song sparrow, and the yellow rump warbler rounded out a list of 9 species that accounted for more than 50% of the more than 1,000 birds that were documented during that 1990 survey. It's not just us, it's not just the Park Service who thinks these are important places. In 2007, the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative published this book, Important Bird Areas of Wisconsin, Critical Sites for the Conservation and Management of Wisconsin's Birds. And included in this, all these sites all across the state were 2 parts of the Apostle Islands. The first was the Kakagan Bad River Wetlands Forest Corridor, which is on the mainland and on the Bad River Reservation. But if you see that photo on the right, that long finger is Long Island, or sometimes it's not an island at all, it's just a peninsula, but it is part of the lakeshore, and it was included in this Kakagan Bad River complex as being an important bird area. And what they said specifically was that Long Island contains extensive beach and dune communities, as well as areas of dry pine oak forest. It's an outstanding migratory concentration area in both fall and spring, with tens of thousands of birds passing through there in those shoulder seasons. It's also one of the most popular nesting areas for piping plovers in the islands.
So who knew about those thousands of birds? Except, of course, the researchers do know. That was one of them, Ted Gostomski from the National Park Service, with a portion of his presentation, A Singing Wilderness, Songbirds of the Apostle Islands, as part of the Apostle Islands 50th Anniversary Symposium. We're speaking about the symposium with Jeff Renicki, Executive Director of the Friends of the Apostle Islands. Another presentation that I found interesting, they all are, but was Underwater Terrain, the bottom of Lake Superior, what's down there, what it looks like. Were you able to sit in on that one?
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful program. It speaks greatly to the resources of Lake Superior and the power of Lake Superior, that we think of the lake as the surface of the lake, but it's an entire ecosystem all the way through the different levels of temperatures in the water, and then of course what happens on the lakeshore beneath, and not to mention all the cultural artifacts from, you know, shipwrecks to brownstone pilings and pieces of brownstone. It's like an entire museum underwater. It's a whole world that most of us don't even think about.
You know, I now know where I lost my car keys.
Now, yeah, I was going to say, if they could drain Lake Superior, first of all, a lot of us would find our car keys. I would find several of my cell phones. But we'd also be opening up an incredible museum of artifacts of shipwrecks and all sorts of cultural artifacts that are preserved down there. And one thing to note about the National Lakeshore of the Apostle Islands is the boundary of the lakeshore extends a quarter mile out from each one of the islands and from the mainland unit. So we do have a large part of this park is actually underwater.
Well, let's hear a little bit from that presentation. This is from The Earth is Not Flat and Neither is the Lake, Underwater Landscapes of the Apostle Islands by Jake Lace, again from the National Park Service.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Jake Lace, and I am the regional fisheries biologist for the Midwest region of the National Park Service. And today I will be giving some updates on our lake bottom mapping project. This is a close-up from the Gull Island Shoal. And you can see some interesting features here that are probably a good part of why this is such an important area for lake trout. These ridges that you see in the image are around 2 to 3 meters wide and 2 to 3 meters tall. And they're comprised largely of cobble and boulder substrates. And then if we look at the Oak Island Shoal, there are a couple of things that I'll point out here. We mapped this area to get some additional detail on the shoal and the potential fisheries habitat of that shoal. And the shoal itself shows up as a kind of bright red orange circular area. Like I said, we went to look at the shoal, but the highlight of the day was really this kind of riverine feature to the northeast of the shoal on the lake floor, which was a complete surprise to us when we mapped it. And I've heard of people talk about the trench or the channel near Oak Island, but I wasn't expecting to see this much detail in our mapping. And if you look closely, it looks really similar to an alluvial river channel on land, complete with meanders in the channel and gravel bars. And the next couple of slides will show some details a little closer up. So here's a little closer view. Sand and possibly clay ridge formation to the south end of the shoal. It's kind of in light green and turquoise there. That ridge is about 10 meters high. And then the valley of the riverine channel that's in blue is about 120 meters wide and 10 meters deep. And the channel itself that shows up kind of in that bright purple color is more than 15 meters wide in places and over 3 meters deep in some places. And the lake depth at this point is around 45 meters. And how it was formed is not completely understood, but I imagine that currents that flow between Oak and Otter and Bear Islands probably play a major role, at least in maintaining this channel. So the next few slides, I'm going to talk about habitat. And this is getting back to why we're interested in this work. In this example, we're interested in identifying habitat for native and invasive mussels, so zebra mussels or the native mussels. This combined map shows those locations where native mussel habitat would most likely be found, or where the invasive zebra mussels might most likely be found, which would be harder substrates like cobbles and rocks, and possibly in deeper areas. So in addition to the invasive mussel investigations, there are a number of other potential uses for habitat. A couple of examples. There's currently a lot of interest throughout the Great Lakes in restoring populations of cisco and whitefish. And if you've lived in this area at all, you know how important cisco and whitefish are to the local commercial fishery and the recreational fishery. The Apostle Islands is known really as an ideal location to better understand the behavior and habitat selections of these species due to their intact populations in the area. Two specific projects are going to begin this coming summer in 2021 to collect information that can be used to guide restoration efforts elsewhere in the Great Lakes. So even though the populations in Lake Superior are in fairly good shape compared to the other lakes, understanding them helps us with restoration in the lower lakes. Our hope is that we can continue developing these habitat descriptions and habitat maps in these and other locations so that they can be used for multiple applications similar to the ones that I just described.
And that was an excerpt from The Earth is Not Flat and Neither is the Lake, Underwater Landscapes of the Apostle Islands, presented by Jay Glace of the National Park Service. It was one of several scientific, cultural, and educational presentations at the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore 50th Anniversary Virtual Stewardship Symposium held March 30th and 31st. With me to talk about the symposium is Jeff Renicky, Executive Director of the Friends of the Apostle Islands. There's so much to choose from here. In fact, were you able to hit all of the presentations or not? I don't know if you could.
No, I couldn't do all of them. It's right now, one thing your viewers might be interested in, if they missed any or unfortunately missed the whole conference, they will now be available on our website for their own viewing opportunities. So if they just go to friendsoftheapostleislands.org, they can find not only the individual presentations, but there will also be presenters' bios and often accompanying materials for them to dig deep into what truly is a treasure trove of information.
Absolutely. And that website, once again, is friendsoftheapostleislands.org. I guess a couple of panels that bear mentioning are those that looked at longitudinal studies of ecology and climate change and where they're headed.
Well, certainly when an anniversary like this is always a time to look backward and to honor and celebrate the history, but it's also a really good time to look forward. And so no one has a crystal ball, of course, but I don't think you need a crystal ball to realize that global climate change is going to be a major player in what these islands look like. In fact, what our entire world looks like over the next 50 years. I know that they speak of potential wild fluctuations in lake levels, changes in lake temperature, and that will affect the biodiversity and the health and well-being of everyone that uses these islands, including humans. So to study where this is heading with global climate change, I think, is one of the most important things that researchers can do. One of the reasons we do research is in the parks is not only to say where we have been or where we are, but to help us model where we're going.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think a lot about the island's future and that the presenters and you out there can do to help was covered in the wrap-up by Lynn Dominey, the National Park Service Superintendent for the Apostle Islands. Let's hear some of what she had to say.
Bigwich, everyone. Thank you for still being with us here as we come to the conclusion of this two-day symposium. Today, I want to give you a chance just to kind of take a deep breath and sit back and think a little bit about what you've heard over the last two days. And remember that yesterday when we started the symposium, I asked you to think about three things. I asked you as you were listening to each of these sessions to write down one action towards stewardship that you think it's really important for us to think about as we move forward. And yesterday, the three questions I asked you were really very different and for different reasons. The first one I asked you was about your influence on stewardship on this landscape in the past, because it's really important to stop and take time to look back, to recognize those accomplishments, those successes, those efforts of the past, because they're a really important part of the future. The second question that I asked you was more immediate, more about thinking about the impacts of the 2020 pandemic and the personal and professional crisis that we've all had to face over the last year. And the reason that that's so important is because before we move forward, you have to think about the impact that this has had on you and try to find something positive from this crisis. Because you have to acknowledge your resilience before you can think even a little bit about the future. So as we think about my third question, I asked you about what actions should we take individually or together to steward this place between now and 2050. And remember some of the great examples that you already heard about stewardship efforts that people decided they were going to do. And because they did them, they changed the course of the impacts that people were having on those resources. You heard a little bit about efforts for lake trout recovery and eagle recovery and invasives management and a whole bunch of different recommendations as you were listening over the last 2 days. And it's really important to have hope and to be positive, both about our responsibilities, but the possibilities. Because we've heard from many people how important it is for people to understand what's happening and begin to address what we can do about it. So you heard many of the presenters say, you know, what's really important here is collaboration, working together. Because as you know, nature doesn't know our boundaries. It doesn't know human boundaries. It doesn't care about where the edges of the park or where the sky begins or the water ends. It is all on this landscape about collaboration, and stewardship has to start there to protect our watersheds, our forests, our shorelines, all the habitats. One of the things I was really excited about when I first got here 2 years ago was I realized, wow, look at the things that have already been done here. And here's an example. This is the tribal adaptation menu. There's probably a lot of you in the symposium that were a part of this process to help us understand how you think about stewardship from an Ojibwe perspective. And then I found something that I was really excited about as well. And this is the Treaty Natural Resources Plan created by Red Cliff. It's a stewardship plan that looks at the next 10 years of stewardship. And I'm going to apologize if I say it wrong. There's a really unique title on this plan, and it's called Ganawinjagade. And underneath it says, it is taken care of, protected. We take care of, protect, keep it. And this was one of the first management plans that I read when I got here. And I thought, wow, what a great foundation for us to begin to look at very inclusive stewardship of this place and the care of it. So all of these things together have built an amazing foundation for us moving forward. And I hope that what we can do as we end today is just to think about what's next. And we hope that you will be a part of being next with us and that you'll continue to think about your role, either as a researcher or a partner, as a teacher, as a volunteer, because all of us play a really important role in the future of this place. And that really starts with caring and respecting and working together. McGwich.
And that was an excerpt from the closing remarks of the Apostle Islands 50th Anniversary Symposium by Lynn Dominey, the superintendent of the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore. And we've been speaking with Jeff Renicki, the executive director of the Friends of the Apostle Islands. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. And again, if people want to see more of this conference, they can go to our website at friendsoftheapostleislands.org, and it is all there for them.
All right. Coming up, the Apostle Islands in poetry.
The passing ship, every nation's gonna be shaken, put it together, don't let it slip. It's time you try living on the high side of the bay. You need a rest.
Life's like poetry, and in the poem day, until now, there's always been a missing line.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. So now that you've heard the science behind the Apostle Islands, let's turn to the art. And what subject could be more inspiring? Well, that inspiration has led to two artistic projects. One is called Islands Intersections, in which one visual artist and one poet is paired with each of the 15 presenters from the program we've just discussed. Their art and poems will be displayed at the Washburn Cultural Center during the month of June. The other is for those of us who know our ABCs, which means everybody. 26 artists and 26 poets were asked to create works about the islands for each letter of the alphabet to be published as a book. They'll be presented in a virtual reception on April 26th, but you get to hear some of them right here. Coordinating all of this is Bayfield Poet Laureate Lucy Terrell. Welcome to Simply Superior, Lucy.
Thank you very much.
So did I get all that right? I think I forgot to say those activities are free, except I assume you have to purchase the book.
You could purchase the book, but you don't have to have the book to participate in the virtual reception.
Right.
What I plan to do is share screen and have both the artwork and the poems visible to anyone who's Zooming to participate.
All right. Well, I'm going to predict that after that, people are going to want to purchase the book, and I'm just going to go out and endorse it right here. All right. So, so you have two poems in the collection. What are the subjects, and what was the inspiration behind them?
The ABC topics, there's one or two for the letters, and the topics for N are National Park Service and Nelson, as in Gaylord Nelson. So the poem that I wrote about Gaylord Nelson is an acrostic. So if you saw the poem on the page, you could read his name down the first letter of each line. And it talks about his inspiration for Earth Day, but also as the mover and shaker behind the establishment of the Apostle Islands as the national lakeshore that it is today.
Right.
So it has a title that isn't a surprise, Gaylord Anton Nelson. Gifted orator as Wisconsin senator, Gaylord Nelson advocated for Apostle Islands National Lakeshore as, yes, the best chance to protect wild country, land, lakeshore waters from development. On his account, in his honor, beaches, cliffs, caves, islands recovering from logging, farming, quarrying are designated in perpetuity Gaylord Nelson Wilderness. Are we able? Yes. Are we willing? That's unanswered, Nelson spoke, as he championed tirelessly for one issue, taking care of our environment. He stood strong, rallied many, organized Earth Day, insisted ecology is a big science, not a narrow one, a big concept. Because he cared, the National Park Service and all of us owe him a great debt. Each acre of dune, forest, bog, each sparkling bay, each lakeshore mile of wild celebrates 50 years in 2020. The seventh generation, too, needs to see this land untrammeled. On Earth Day, Tia Nelson misses her father the most. Never forget his efforts. We should miss him every day.
And I was able to follow along even on the radio and catch those first letters of each line. We're speaking with Lucy Terrell. She is the Poet Laureate of Bayfield and coordinator of the A is for Apostle Islands Art and Poetry Project. So you have a second poem in the collection?
I do. It's for the letter X, which for any ABC book is always a challenge. But the people who were helping me choose the topic or topics for each letter, it was easy for us to settle on X is for crossing, Xing to the islands. Because for centuries, people have gone back and forth or around the islands in birch bark canoes, ships, catamaran cruises, kayaks, all manner of transportation.
Including driving over the ice road.
Right, or maybe even swimming.
Right, but not while you're trying to drive over the ice roads.
No, different season.
All right, well, let's hear that one.
Yes, the title is To Devil's Island Sea Caves. The Apostle Island cruise ship departs in a chop that slaps on hull. Dark nimbus clouds bulge down to spill a pelting rain, torrential now. The captain orders all from upper deck when spears of lightning streak the leaden gray. He says we'll wait it out in the lee of oak. I worry when wind jostles, waves thrash boat, lake roll turbulence spits unruly spray. Then storm blows past, the boat again sets forth on its water route, threads islands heading north. No squalls, teal surface ripples, smaller swells. Sky clears its gloomy gray with blue pastels. Sun burns sienna cliffs and waved carved shore as time stands still. The crossing smooth once more.
Great. And much better than xylophone or X-ray, by the way.
We are speaking with
Bayfield Poet Laureate Lucy Terrell. And was there anything surprising or unexpected about this project for you?
I think the most surprising thing was the amazing contributions of the artists and poets. They gave of their time and their talents. And what I like to say about the ABC book is that the entire book is way more than the sum of the parts. There's something about it being gathered together to depict a window into this special place through art and poetry.
All right. Well, let's peer through that window with the next poet. Thank you, Lucy Terrell, for sharing your work.
You're welcome.
Well, next is Diana Randolph of Drummond in Southern Bayfield County, and she was assigned the letter O. So, Diana, what did you do with it?
Well, O is for old growth forest and also Ojibwe. So I did a lot of research about this and then made my personal connections to it and wrote a poem called Forest Mosaic. And here it is. Forest Mosaic. This is the woodland I imagined as a child, tree trunks too wide to wrap my arms around, old growth northern forests of the Apostle Islands, diverse with so many trees, including balsam fir, white pine, red maple, red oak, basswood, balsam poplar, and hemlock, some over 300 years old. After Ojibwe migrated here, they thrived on the islands for centuries, shaping the land with their dwellings and harvesting trees and plants for many uses, including sugar maple for maple syrup, white cedar for ceremonies, white birch for baskets and canoes, hemlock bark for tanning leather, and for healing, yellow birch bark to treat blood diseases, white spruce twigs as a steam for rheumatism, sweet sesame roots for sore throats, ulcers, and sores. As early lighthouses were built, expansive acres were preserved for keepers and their families for firewood. Raging fires consumed dry logging-era debris, approached edges of the old-growth fortress of trees and moist, lush understory, then flames ceased. Now light filters through gaps in the towering canopy, where dead trees fall in windstorms, decay into rich soil. Seedlings emerge, plenty of openings for wildlife habitat, contrasts of multiple of ages, structure and textures, interconnected pieces of all life in the forest mosaic.
And that was Diana Randolph of Drummond with Forest Mosaic. Hey, I'm wondering if you, would you count Longfellow as an influence? Well, because he has a poem that begins, "This is the forest primeval."
The murmuring of pride.
A little channeling, I suppose.
Yes, yes, he spoke to me.
Well, I don't know if he ever saw the apostles, but if he did, he'd certainly have a lot more to say, and you're saying it for him. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, our next one up is John Adler, also known as, or better known as, Son of Mel, I understand. Correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And who is Mel, and how did Son of Mel take over your persona?
Mel is my father's name, and I owe all of what I do to my parents and those that come before them. So I host, I'm a performing songwriter and storyteller and poet and hoster of spoken word and music open mics.
Well, your assignment was the letter F. So tell us what you did with it and the title of the poem, and then let's hear it.
All right. Such a great project that Lucy put together, meeting science with poetic expression. So the letter was F, and it was fir and Fresnel.
So how do you spell Fresnel? I take it you're not referring to the city in California.
Oh, no, this is Fresnel Lens. F, R is in Robert, E is in Eleanor, S is in snail, N is in Nancy, E is in every, and L as in Larry. The Fresnel Lens was invented by a man named Fresnel, who found a way to magnify candlelight to increase light's ability to pierce through fog and greater distances. So this was the advent of the modern lighthouse. And and so the Apostle Islands are filled with lighthouses. And so so to combine, like, when fir met Fresnel, this is when all the furred animals of the Apostle Islands in the Northland first came into contact with the Fresnel Lens.
Got it. All right. Well, let's hear how that fared.
So the name of the poem is When Fir Met Fresnel. When fir met Fresnel, fox, fisher, bear, beaver, and all other members of the four-legged furred clans had been meeting every fall for as long as any could remember. Long since the season of silence's long retreat of icy sheets and blowing snows, windy reminders of entire ages, now lasting a few months, keeping distant past from drifting into forgotten memory. Their councils had long kept the reverence and remembrance as they retold the stories of thundering footsteps once made by woolly mammoths. The mountain ranges grown and withered, the ancient cauldron now turned into infinite lake. The first two-leggeds who came, followed by those in boats, who came in search of the food growing on water. They made their peace with these, though shorelines now delivered bearded men in boats. Unlike their two-legged cousins, they came countless, like the stars, day and night, burning stone into sculpted steel and glass, from which to make a night-seeing sun, turning like the owl's head, guiding ships to shores. The clans had never seen a Fresnel lens, concentric circles of glass honed, turning dim light into a searching sun through densest night. For generations now, some had counseled further retreat, even as their numbers dwindled in the stacks, tides of hides traded, sent east. But all listened to Bear, who yawned, then spoke. The sun and stars are meant to guide us, and while we seek cover in storms, they come and go, perhaps lost. We must not retreat, but stay, my friends, to light the way to lost ways. Though many more may surely pass, we must remember, forgiveness gives up all hope for a better past.
All right. We've just heard When Fir Met Fresnel for the letter F by John Adler, a.k.a. Son of Mel. Thank you for joining us.
I can't thank you enough for doing this. This is such a pleasure and an honor. Thank you.
You're quite welcome, and thank you for sharing it. And we have time to feature one more poet from the ABC book of the Apostle Islands. We're speaking with Jude General.
Hello.
Hello there. You were assigned the letter I, and with that you came up with something about the ice caves.
That's right.
Can you help us explore them?
Okay. Well, ice is a hard topic because it's not as romantic in some ways as if you're giving something a cozier feeling. It's rather stark, and the ice caves, though, are just a transition of beauty when the ice affects them. So it was something I had to think about for a while, and my experiences up in that area and crossing the ice over to Madeline or walking through the caves up by Port Wing, and this is what I came up with. Tell me of ice. Tell me your secrets, Gitchigumi. I want to know what alchemy spins the summer sky to gold and black, magic nights. Tell me of your love in gentle swells. Then from where comes the anger of rage against the shore? Tell me of rain and wind and 28-foot waves, and I will tell you how fear paralyzes. Tell me of the ice roads that scar your face. In winter, of ice that glitters in treacherous beauty, glazing rock in dark places, luring both the timid and bold to cross frozen water and enter the winter temple of the gods. Yes, tell me of ice. What sorcery turns your capricious scatterings of water and cold into glorious caverns? Tell me of creation and the wizardry of crystal Arctic air, locked in time, bannering Earth's mixed blessings of danger and thrilling beauty. Tell me of ice, Gitchigumi. That's it.
And that was Tell Me of Ice by Jude General. And what town do you live in, by the way?
Well, I'm down by Long Lake, which is south of Hayward.
Ah.
Great.
Just your backyard.
Right. All right. Thank you for sharing with us.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you, and enjoy Poetry Month. It's a special time of year.
All right. Coming up, the regional news and review after this. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and I'm joined by Brooks Johnson of the Star Tribune's North Report team. Hello, Brooks.
Good morning, Robin.
And our own Superior-based reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio, Danielle Kading. Hi, Danny.
Hi, Robin.
So, Danny, where can I go in Douglas County to get vaccinated, and who is it being offered to? And you can guess that I already know the answer to this question.
Yeah, so actually on Thursday, the governor, Governor Shoni Evers, and the Wisconsin Department of Health Services announced that they would be doing a vaccination clinic in Douglas County, and that's going to be starting on Tuesday, and it's going to be located at the University of Wisconsin Superior in the Westman Arena. And, you know, that's going to be open to everyone 16 and older because they moved up the eligibility for shots on that. And I believe the Douglas County Clinic plans to administer at least around 200 doses each day. They might have capacity to do up to 500 doses if the vaccine is available. And that's going to run from Tuesday through Saturday from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. Again, opening on Tuesday next week.
Okay. And we had local elections this week. Last week, you told us about a referendum in Ashland County to try to fill their depleted coffers. Did the voters support it?
No, they didn't. And this is much like back in 2018 when Ashland County brought a referendum to increase property taxes then, where they had suggested raising it by roughly $1 million. And this time, I think it was around $938,000 each year for the next 5 years. And we saw 60% of voters who turned out in Ashland County vote that referendum down. A couple years ago, that failed with 64% of residents who voted opposing that property tax increase. And so this is going to create some tough decisions for Ashland County leaders. You know, they are facing what the county administrator calls a fiscal crisis, and they are looking at cutting unmandated services, services they're not required to provide under state law. And that could include things like, you know, services provided by UW Extension, the Ashland County Aging Unit, and Bay Area Rural Transit, which provides transportation in the Shawamigan Bay Area. So there are going to be some tough questions or tough choices facing county leaders now moving forward.
All right. Well, just as with the governor's announcement about the vaccinations in Douglas County, another statewide official is focusing on an issue that has local interests. The attorney general has a message about spearfishing.
Yeah, the attorney general, Josh Call, along with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources Secretary Preston Cole, they are warning people against interfering with tribal treaty rights as tribal spearfishers head out for the spring harvest. You know, it usually gets underway this time of year once the ice melts. And so there was an incident that occurred last year that's prompting this. That incident involved gunfire near tribal spearfishers on Little St. Germain Lake in Vilas County. And, you know, a group of tribal fishermen were out on the lake and they heard shouting at them and gunshots. And so the perpetrator of that incident, it was a 62-year-old resident named James Kelsey, and he was later convicted of interfering with hunting, fishing, and trapping in order to pay a fine. And now, you know, this spring, wardens with the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission are going to be working with state and local law enforcement to conduct patrols in the area where tribal members are going to be spearfishing. And the Attorney General, Josh Call, is warning that, you know, anyone found guilty of interfering with lawful hunting, fishing, or trapping could face a $10,000 fine or up to 9 months in jail. And it could possibly be elevated to a hate crime if the act appears based on race or other factors. So they're warning that this is potentially very serious criminal activity if people are interfering with tribal treaty rights.
All right. Well, Brooks, on the Minnesota side, courtesy of the Wisconsin side, it seems, the Catholic Diocese of Duluth is getting a new bishop, courtesy of Green Bay.
Yes, we will have a new bishop installed in Duluth in May as a 66-year-old, the Reverend Daniel Felton, will be joining the diocese. He was appointed by Pope Francis this week, and he succeeds the late Bishop Paul Serba, who died suddenly in December 2019. The diocese hasn't had a bishop since then. The Reverend Michael Malloy was installed as the new bishop in Duluth in October, but he resigned following an accusation of sexual abuse of a minor at the Diocese of Rapid City, South Dakota. So the Duluth Diocese includes more than 44,000 Catholics and 71 parishes covering a large swath of northeastern Minnesota, and Felton will be installed on May 20th.
All right. Well, with all that geography and his trip from Green Bay, he shouldn't have much trouble getting here, but he doesn't have to go through Canada.
Yeah, he wouldn't be able to if he tried. there's some tensions flaring at the border as U.S. and Canadian lawmakers are both looking for solutions to the longstanding international border closure that has barred non-essential travel into Canada. So Canadians can travel into America and elsewhere, but they're required to show negative COVID-19 tests, as are other residents who are trying to get back through Manitoba, for example, to the northwest angle. So for those listeners not familiar, you know, Minnesota has this sort of stovepipe top, this little exclave, the northwest angle, that is only accessible by road through Canada. And with the border closure and no exception for the 100 or so year-round residents up there, people are essentially feeling like they're being held hostage by a foreign government, as one resort owner told me. So, you know, legislators and lawmakers are really trying to push for something, some sort of small exception. But so far, the Canadian government is not budging, and they are simply saying we're going to keep it closed for all non-essential travel for the foreseeable future. And no word yet either on vaccine passports, quote unquote, for those travelers who can prove vaccination to get across the border. Although if a COVID-19 negative test is good enough, who knows, maybe then they'll move along to these vaccine passports.
All right. Well, who knew we had an international no man's land in our listening area? Back in Duluth, how's Duluth doing anyway? The mayor took time this week to talk about that.
Yes, Mayor Emily Larson gave her State of the City address this week and you know, proposed a number of new major initiatives, including her goal to be the greenest city in the country and to reform the police department in a way that makes it more trusted, more community-based. So just kind of taking through these initiatives, she talked about community policing 2.0, and that directly addressed last month's Duluth branch NAACP news conference, where they called out the racial disparities in arrest rates and in use of force incidents. While white residents comprise about 90% of the city's population, half of all use of force incidents involved people of color last year. Also, the Housing Trust Fund initiative Larson proposed includes $2 million to sort of help rehab or renovate dilapidated units and develop infill sites and pretty much address this really steep just shortage of housing in the Duluth area. And Superior's seeing it too. There's just a total shortage of housing, both rental at all income levels and for those to buy. Larson also wants to take a stab at getting more broadband competition in town. She criticized the largest local provider in the city, Spectrum, for saying that, you know, it's immoral, quote unquote, she said, to raise prices on folks, and that they feel, you know, residents are not feeling like they're getting the best deal they can. That would take $1 million out of federal coronavirus relief money to hopefully recruit new broadband providers. It's not going as far as Superior's proposal, as we've heard, to possibly, you know, bring in a municipal run provider, but maybe that could come down the line. A few other things. Duluth wants to put in a 311 line so people can call with complaints instead of just leaving them on their Facebook page. And solar power was also a big point that Larson wanted to make, that she wants to have a large-scale solar array in the city in the next 3 years.
All right. Well, it sounds like ambitious proposals. We've been speaking with Danielle Kading, the Superior-based reporter for WPR News. Thank you, Danny.
Thank you, Robin.
And Brooks Johnson of the Star Tribune's North Report team. Thank you, Brooks.
Thank you, Robin.
You can read the stories by Brooks and the Star Tribune's entire Twin Ports Bureau at www.startribune.com/northreport, and be sure to subscribe to their local newsletter. And that's it for this edition of Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. We leave you with a piano cover of Gordon Lightfoot's Seven Island Suite, performed by the Duluth Superior Symphony Orchestra's erstwhile principal horn player, Jim Pospisil. Stay safe, everyone.